If the element can hold out long enough and face the torment of the system until the system's energy is depleted, if the element can look the system in the eye and say, I'm still here, asshole, then the system will have to change, adapt, mutate. And if this happens, it'll prove my fucking point.
Which is what?
Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. We talk about our favorite records. Talking Records Podcast. We're so glad you tuned in. Thank you all for listening. You showed up to the right place. Jed and his friends dive deep and analyze the records we have grown to love. We'll tell you how we found the band, then give you a track-by-track breakdown of all the songs. So grab your favorite beverage and pull up a seat. Today we'll look at another record in its entirety.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Talking Records Podcast. My name is Jed. You are listening to a podcast that aims to gather up every bit of information we can find on albums we love. We like to put it all here in this podcast. I'm joined today by Steve from the bands Symphony of Distraction and LaMonta. How's it going, Steve?
Good. Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Welcome to the show. We got to talking about the Angus soundtrack recently.
Yeah, one of my favorites. Best soundtrack ever, yeah.
It's a great soundtrack. So we're going to dive into that soundtrack today and talk about these great songs, how all these punk rock tunes ended up in a movie, you know, all that good stuff.
Yeah.
But Steve, before I do that, I want to ask you about the Symphony of Distraction collections of songs that didn't make it onto some of your albums, vinyl that you just released.
We just kind of over the years had stuff laying around, and it kind of got to a point where we had so much of it that we were like, well, we could just, you know, throw this together and put it out. And there was some stuff that we kind of reworked a little because, you know, we didn't put it on a record because there was parts that bugged us, and we kind of reworked those. And then some of the stuff was just, you know, it appeared on a comp or, and then some was just completely unreleased. Our last full length record was called Horse. And so we just kind of thought it was funny. We were like, what if we just called it Horse Shit? You know, and it was just okay. You know, and the cover art kind of encompasses all of our previous releases, and you know, it kind of just came together pretty good. Like we were pretty happy with how it turned out, because the problem with a record like that is it can sound pretty disjointed and and you know, it just doesn't flow. But luckily we're such kind of a one trick pony that nothing is ever going to sound too far off. And it came out a few weeks ago and doing pretty good, and we're pretty happy with it. I missed, there's a typo on one of the songs on every copy that was pressed.
Oh no.
And ironically it's the song Brainiac, and every copy of Horse Shit says Braniac on it.
Well, you're just gonna have to change the name of the song, I think.
yeah well, my a friend of mine said, you know, how do they know you're just not really into Bran? And I was like, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So,
you know, get your fiber.
Yeah. So
you press 90 copies on vinyl, and that's it. So that's pretty neat.
We just did, because we don't really do anything with labels or anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, a band our size, it just doesn't really make sense for somebody else to get involved. And we just decided we would do a super small run and pressed it ourselves. And surprisingly, I mean, I think we got all of them moved like the first day that they were on sale,
that's amazing,
which was cool, you know. But but we had the talk where it was like, well, what if we did 200? And it's like, and what happens is then you end up with, you know, 50 copies in your apartment or whatever the hell. And so it was like, it'd be better to just have them, see if we can sell them all, and that's that, you know. It worked out. We did have, though, when they first got shipped out, we had a couple friends of ours, like Jason, the drummer from my other band, LaMonta, mm-hmm. and then Pat, who's in Symphony of Distraction, their copies got shipped out, and they were sending me and Jay pictures being like, what the fuck is this? And it was like a 3 foot wide gaming mouse pad. So the warehouse, because we take everything we make, we ship to a warehouse and they handle all our distribution, because we realized long ago, we're not cut out to go down to the post office three right. times a week. It's just like, yeah. nobody would ever get shit.
No one's you know? Doing that. Yeah.
yeah. And so Jay found a company and he uses them for his project Lonely Bunker too. Mm-hmm. So it's just, we press something, ship to the warehouse, they handle everything else. Yeah. Like Pat was like, what is this? And then I get a text from Jason and he's like, what is this? And so we started to freak. Cause I mean, some of these orders, I mean, you know, they're going to Japan.
Oh, so Europe, they got a mouse pad instead of a record.
Yeah. There was no record.
Oh my God. I thought the mouse pad came with the record.
Oh no, I wish. And Jimmy from Symphony Distraction got one too. And so we're like shit in our pants because yeah. we're like, you know, people paid for these, you know, and yeah. and all the receipt, everything was the correct information. It was like one copy, horseshit, vinyl. And they got, and so it was happening multiple times. And we were like, oh my God, like, what are we going to do? Like, we're just like, we're going to have to just eat our balls on this record. Like, we're not making any money. Like, and luckily, as far as I know, we didn't hear of it from anybody else. So if it's going to happen, the few people it happened to that are like, you know, two of them are in the band and one of them's been like one of my best friends for decades. It's yeah. like, thank God it wasn't widespread. Cause that like triumphant moment of like, wow, we sold them out day one
right.
quickly turned into like
panic.
Oh,
yeah.
No, what are we going to do?
Like, oh my yeah. God, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Today, Steve and I are going to be talking about the soundtrack to the movie Angus. Have you seen the film?
Oh, countless times. I just watched it again last night just because I knew you were doing it, but I've seen it a million times. Years ago, there was an online petition to get it pressed onto DVD, and I signed the petition. I was like,
oh, you did? Nice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Nice. You got the VHS still.
I've got
man.
My VHS copy here. Yeah.
Awesome.
All right. Well, we'll talk a little bit about this movie as we go through the soundtrack. All right. So. The soundtrack to the movie Angus was released on my 15th birthday, August 22nd, 1995. The album was released on Reprise Records. This was a little less than a month before the movie came out in September. The soundtrack was produced by former Paramount Pictures head Don Steele and Rob Cavallo. Of course, we all know Rob Cavallo, famous for yeah. producing Dookie by Green Day. The music supervisors for the film were lawyers Elliot Kahn, who had played guitar in Sha Na Na. I don't know if you knew that.
Wow, that's a deep dive.
Yeah, and Jeff Saltzman, who at the time also managed two of the soundtrack's artists, Green Day and the Muffs. The management team, smashing their names together and going by Con Man, had been quietly operating out of a small office on the Oakland-Berkeley border for about 6 or so years until they brought in Green Day, who proceeded to record Dookie and, you know, sell 4 million copies by the end of 94. And, you know, as they say, the rest is history, right?
Yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Put all these people on the map. Yeah, they were. I guess they were also Offspring's lawyers at the time.
Yeah, so I listened to an interview with Charlie Talbert, who plays Angus.
Oh, nice.
He was talking about the soundtrack, and apparently it was supposed to be Offspring. It wasn't supposed to be Green Day. That was going to be the signature band. Ah. And yeah, and he talked about a scene where it's like him and Troy, Chris Owen, are just kind of, it's like a montage, and they're kind of like rocking out. And he's like, they were actually listening to keep them separated in that and stuff. So,
oh, that's so interesting. And to kind of like add more layers to that, if you look at the back of the vinyl, which we'll talk about in a minute, or on the soundtrack, it's, you know, the back of the CD, you can actually mm-hmm. see an Offspring poster hanging.
Yeah.
mm-hmm. in their little what is it? They're like their garage hangout.
They're like yeah, like the science den. Yeah,
the science den. I don't know. Which like cracks me up looking at it because you know like someone was tasked to like make this room look like teenager-y, dude, and like what can we do?
If you read like all the writing, because it's all like, you know, black light, like glow writing, and it's like equals MC, who cares? And like you know, so it's just like this angsty like shit that where it's like no, nobody would do that. Nobody. Right.
So bad. But like you know, like when we were teenagers, we're like, whoa, I wanna hang out in that place.
Oh, for sure. For sure, dude.
They're allowed to write on their walls. What?
Yeah, yeah.
So these guys are Offspring's lawyers, and they're also at the time starting the 510 record label, which the Dancehall Crashers were signed to when they released Lockjaw. So these guys are just super busy, you know. They were just like riding this wave.
They knew what was going on in the I guess partial mainstream. Everybody wasn't mainstream at that point, but yeah, talk about your finger on the pulse, you know.
But pretty cool though that these two guys, you know, were able to somehow land the soundtrack. You know, they're listed as co-executive album producers, so they obviously had a hand in this thing, working with Rob Cavallo, and it was just like a let's open up the gate and like let in all these bands that were working. It's like a perfect opportunity.
Yeah, and if your career path started as playing guitar for Sha Na Na, what a crazy addition to your story.
But the funny thing is about this is it didn't even last like a year. By 95, Green Day actually parted ways with these guys. They had argument over merchandising or something. Huh. And after that, it's like, that's the end of that. You don't hear about these two guys anymore. And
I remember, I think it was the Insomniac tour or something. I remember seeing an interview with Green Day on the MTV News or whatever they would call it. And they were talking about how they had gotten rid of their management and they were just managing themselves at that point. Yeah. Right. Which is insane to think of a band doing stadium tours, selling millions of records. And even if you did it for a week, that is bonkers to manage yourself at that level. But so it sounds like the management that they parted ways with was the con man thing, which come up with a better name if you want people to stick around.
Seriously. In the movie, you know, Mazzy Star has Fade Into You. There's a Peter Gabriel tune on here, Washing of the Water.
Yeah.
And there's a handful of other songs in the movie that are not on the soundtrack. So, I think actually the Smoking Popes have a second song.
They have Rubella's in there.
Rubella, yeah, that's
and
right.
They,
that's
and Rubella's movie. Actually the first song that they play by the Smoking Popes in the movie,
So interesting that these songs didn't go on. I'm wondering if like they just couldn't get the soundtrack rights to the Mazzy Star song or the Peter Gabriel, or if they were like, these songs don't really fit.
We're going for this new hip, you know, pop punk kind of thing. But the Mazzy Star one, I actually made a note about that, is the weird one to me because that is a huge scene in that movie.
That was an important scene and a huge song.
And it was just like, they let the song play pretty long in the movie. It's you know, and then to just be like, Nah, you're not on the soundtrack. It's, you know, it's
if you
strange.
Like that one, you're gonna have to go buy the album.
I
wonder if she had like some agreement that it could be in the movie, but they couldn't put it on the soundtrack.
Yeah, I don't know.
Driving business her way to get. I don't know. All this is business end stuff to me is fascinating.
I mean, I remember hearing about. And you remember that movie, Can't Hardly Wait?
Yeah. Yep.
Another fantastic '90s movie, and that band Eve Six had signed on to do the soundtrack, and between when they signed and when the soundtrack came out, they blew up. Mm-hmm. And they were like, no, you can't use our song, or if you want to, you got to give us a lot more money or whatever.
Oh, wow.
And
the
company was like, no, we don't. Like, you signed it, you know?
Yeah, we've already got you.
Yeah. So yeah, I wonder if it was one of those things where maybe it was like, as they were developing a soundtrack, you know, Mazzy Star just skyrocketed. And then it was like,
I'm too big for this.
Shitty little teen movie. I'm an artist.
Well, it being a soundtrack, there isn't a whole lot to say about, you know, the behind the scenes stuff. It's just a collection of songs that they got together on this thing. So I'm going to move right into Steve. I want to know, like, how did you get into this soundtrack?
So, I mean, this came out in 95, and I was full on obsessed with Green Day. You know, yeah. So you said it came out on your 15th birthday.
Yeah.
And so I turned 16 a couple months after it came out.
Yeah.
I was full on Green Day, and, you know, obviously deep diving down the, you know, Lookout wormhole and all yeah. things punk rock. And, you know, back when they used to, like, you could only hear new stuff on the radio, they played JAR on the local radio station where I grew up. It blew my mind. This is the first thing that Green Day had put out since Dookie. Yeah. You know, Insomniac was coming in a couple months, but this was your first new anything from them.
Mm.
And mm-hmm. so I, hook, line, and sinker was like, I heard that song and I was like, I'm getting this soundtrack. And I lived in a small town, like a few thousand people in northern Michigan. And the closest kind of real record store was an hour and a half away.
Oh, wow.
And I was 15, so I couldn't drive. And my mom, God bless her, super cool, took me on a Saturday, like drove me down just to buy this soundtrack. I was instantly obsessed with it, you know.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And then, of course, it made me, I love, you know, because you said it was like a couple months before the movie came out. I remember it was before yeah. the movie. But yeah. by the time the movie came out, I had listened to the soundtrack so many times that I was like, this movie is going to have to suck so bad for me to not love it.
Right.
Because I was like, this soundtrack is amazing. And I just want to see how they use these songs.
Yeah.
And then my mom drove me the hour and a half away to that same place to see the movie. Like when it came out.
Theater.
Yeah.
And wasn't it amazing to sit in a theater and hear music that you actually liked, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So exciting.
And I remember thinking it was so cool that they actually like mentioned Green Day in the movie. Like so right. silly, but you know, it's like, they're trying to win tickets or whatever.
Third caller, yeah.
And yeah, and it's like they mentioned by name, like, oh, Green Day. Like, you know, it wasn't just something in the background. And I just thought,
right.
oh, this is so awesome. How about you? Was it, did you just kind of fall into it? Or was it you heard the Green Day song first and then?
Yeah, so very similar story. I first heard JAR during the summer of 95 when actually my father, who worked as the general manager of an alternative rock radio station, showed me the single. And wow. he goes, "Want to hear the new Green Day song?"
Wow.
And I mean, I didn't even know Green Day was putting anything out. I heard that song. He played it in his office. And from that opening bass line on through to the catchy chorus, I just absolutely loved it. And
yeah.
my dad was the one who explained to me that it was actually going to be in a movie. So just like you, wow. when the movie came out in the fall, I went and saw it. And, you know, the movie, it's about a bunch of teenagers. I was a teenager.
Yeah.
Doing teenager things, teasing, dick jokes, you know, all the yeah. good stuff. Popular kids, nerds, school dances. It was like right in my wheelhouse of like, this is my world, you know?
Yeah, well, and I mean, that's kind of the thing too, you know, that I was thinking about was like, if you were really into like this soundtrack, there's a good chance that your high school experience was somewhat relatable through, you know, Angus and Troy,
yeah.
where it was right. like, you know, like me, and I'm sure, you know, you, it was like, we were like weirdo, kind of right. outsider, nerdy kids that, you know, it was like, I mean, I got fucked with in high school all the time and bullied by, you know, just the kind of expendable dickheads that I'm sure still live in their mom's basement. But like, but it was like watching that movie. It wasn't just, you know, like watching a just sort of generic teen comedy. It right. felt so much more relatable, and to be that age. And, you know, and I loved how they showed that it was like, Angus would get pissed. It wasn't just poor me, like yeah. no one understands me. Cause it was like, that was real. Like
yeah.
you know what I
Absolutely.
Mean? You would go home some days just seething and being like, I don't want to go back to that place ever again. You know? And I love that they like put that in the movie where it was just like, yeah, you can get really angry about this because you should, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah.
It just had that great underlying theme of like bravery and what it really means to be brave and, you know, yeah. kind of pushing through that adversity. And I just remember, yeah, it resonated with me, you know, because I just remember thinking that here's a shitty situation. So what does he do? He powers through it. You know, he makes the best of it. He gets his moment, you know, in the end. Yeah. And you're like, wow, you know, he didn't cower. He didn't back down. He just plunged through and ended up looking like he ended up being the hero, you know?
So yeah.
I mean, there's cliches galore in there, but at the same time, it was nice to see something like that in a movie. You didn't normally see.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, outcasts don't really sell. All the TV shows that were about outcasts, My So-Called Life, didn't last beyond two seasons.
Yeah, and
didn't sell.
And when they would do those, it was like they would do it in this way where it was like, that's not what the weirdos at my school look like. You know what I mean? Like, there's no Jordan Catalano strutting down the halls. And it was just, you know, it just wasn't as believable. And then with Angus, it was like they picked people. It was just so much more realistic than if James Vanderbeek would have played Angus instead of Rick, wouldn't have worked. It would have been a garbage movie, you know?
Right. I also remember watching the movie and seeing the kids dancing at the school dance to punk rock songs and just being like, that must be the coolest thing in the world. Like, you know, they're not dancing to House of Pain. They're dancing to Tilt.
Right. Yeah. The Riverdales. They play that at the dance scene.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Obviously, I just had to have that soundtrack after I heard it. And when I got it, it was just a primer for great punky alternative rock stuff. You know, these bands were like the anti-Collective Soul, Dishwalla, Oasis.
Yeah.
Really huge in 95.
Yeah.
And I mean, don't get me wrong. I appreciate those bands, but there was like an exciting energy about this kind of music for me at that time, you know, building off of Green Day and moving forward with that. And just hearing this disc, it just led me to so many bands. I point to this soundtrack as being my gateway into the Muffs, Smoking Popes, the Riverdales, obviously, Ash, the Dancehall Crashers. And it's just an important piece in my music journey.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, the movie has, you know, kind of faded into obscurity. I mean, like you said, people had to make a petition to get it on Amazon for $6. But it's funny how the soundtrack still remains, you know, not only an entry point into great music, but just a real great, I mean, a comp. It's a great comp, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, you know, I used to have this thing when I was younger that anything that I was really into, whether it was a band or a movie or a book or something, I just assumed if I was into it, it had to be huge. Like, everybody knows what this is. You know what I mean? Because like I said, I grew up in a really small town and it didn't really have a lot of people around me that were into the same things I were into. But I was like, if it made it to me outside of this place, it must just be friggin' massive. That's what I thought about Angus. And then like, as I got older and I would talk to people, you know, Angus. And I'm like, what? Huh? Angus? You know, I was like, what? You didn't see Angus? It's like fucking 16 Candles. Like, you just have to see it.
Yeah. Is that movie with the Shermanator?
Right? Like, everything, man. Major Pain and, like, you know, and then he went on to, like, the American Pie movies. Like, that guy just stayed in his lane and did great, you know?
Yeah.
But.
All right, Steve. Well, I think we should dive into these songs.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. The soundtrack leads off with J.A.R. by Green Day.
And I think it's all right. Better do what I like, 'cause that's the way I wanna live. It's all I give. And I'm sad,
J.R. or Jason Andrew Relva is a song written by bassist Mike Dirnt about his friend who died in a car accident in 1992 when he was 19 years old. It was a song recorded during the band's sessions for the 94 album Dookie. It was engineered by Kevin Army and produced by Rob Cavallo. It makes me think, Steve, why they left this off Dookie instead of like another Mike tune, like Amina Sleepus.
You know? Yeah. And it also makes you wonder what else was Mike Dirnt sitting on?
Yeah.
That like didn't get used. Because I mean, this is an amazing Green Day song. And it doesn't
one of my top five.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, they still play it live.
Like, yeah.
Last time I saw them, they played it, you know. You know, I just sort of wonder what the kind of dynamic was with bringing a song in that, because it's like, obviously Billy Joe is Billy Joe, and
yeah,
you know, writes amazing songs. I mean, like, especially then. But yeah, it's just crazy that, like, you can write this and it sounds like Green Day. It doesn't sound like, you know, I wrote it, but can we kind of fit it in? Like you get with some bands where it's like, oh, yeah, I can tell the main songwriter didn't write this. Still, sure, kind of sounds like them, but there's some differences. Like, not this. This is straight up, like, legit, right, Green Day.
It's right in the pocket, yeah.
Yeah. And also, it's like he wrote it and he's like, I'm gonna give myself my moment, to quote Angus, that bass line, just starting off. And then, you know, at the end, it's just, it's such a great song. It's a great, great song.
I love it. Great lyric. Now I see I'm mortal too. I can't live my life like you. And I think it's all right that I do what I like, because that's the way I want to live. And it's just, you know, a song about realizing one's own mortality. I guess when you're young, I mean, hopefully you don't have too many people in your life that have passed at that time.
Yeah.
It really makes you kind of understand that, whoa, this is real. Like, this could really happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really get that sense from this song. He was looking at it from that point of view.
Yeah. And I feel like there's also in the lyrics too, there's a lot of that just kind of like, you know, fuck you. I'll just do what I want to do, because, yeah, you know, like, yeah. I mean, part of it is this could all end at any moment. But part of it too is also, you know, I feel like I don't have to just do the thing that is laid out for me and everyone else if I don't want
to. That's expected,
you know? Yeah. Yeah.
The song ends in an interesting way. Billy sings, I don't want to make a plan for a day far away. While I'm young and while I'm able, all I want to do is... And instead of a last word, there's just a light cymbal hit. And of course, that always used to drive me crazy when I was young. Like,
yeah.
What?
Yeah, right?
All you want to do is what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel like everybody would immediately just jump to play, but you were like, I don't know.
Well, of course, if you go and you listen to early demos, you can actually hear Mike sing the end part. So it is play. But I like that they cut it off for the final version. I mean, there must have been some kind of discussion around, like, hey, let's leave this kind of open-ended. It makes you think, well, what do I want to do?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a kind of a cool touch.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd love to be like a fly on the wall for that conversation in the studio when they were like, let's drop the last word.
And I always loved how they just throw in that quick harmony on the Day Far Away line.
Yeah.
Because everything is so stripped down at that point. You know, I mean, it's just bass and vocals, and the vocals themselves are kind of in a lower range. And then just sneaking that harmony in is just, there's little things that they've always done. You know, especially in that era, you know, Dookie, Insomniac, Nimrod, where it's like, that's what sets you apart, you know, it's just that ear you have, you know, and who knows, maybe it was just some guy in the studio turning knobs. And so why don't we put but you know, in my heart, I want to believe it was them.
Yeah. Well, I always felt like their harmonies were really smooth, to the point where they were so well done and so well blended that you almost don't know they're there. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, intertwined. Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I remember someone saying, like, oh, there's no backup singer in Green Day. I'm like, well, yeah, there is. You could, but then I was thinking about it. I'm like, yeah, they're so smooth that you don't hear like a guy going like way up high or like doing some in the background.
Yeah. And
so I always appreciated that about them.
Friggin' teenagers. I mean, if you listen to like their first record, or you listen to Kerplunk, and they're just pulling these harmonies off as a three piece, like, you know, I don't know about you. I was in bands when I was 17, and we sure as shit weren't even attempted. We didn't even know what that was, you know?
Yeah.
Why don't you hit the third there? Like, what the hell is the third? You know?
The song was released as a single July 10th, 1995, in preparation for the Angus soundtrack. That's when I heard it. It also appears on Green Day's 2001 Greatest Hits Collection, International Super Hits. All right, let's move on to Jack Names the Planets by Ash.
Jack names the planets after you. Jack names the planets after you. Jack names the planets after you.
From Northern Ireland, Ash released their EP Trailer in the US in June of 1995. It's really just a collection of their first three singles, with Jack Names the Planets being their first one. The song was mixed by Rob Cavallo. The song actually dates back to 1992, when on the strength of this one song, the band was actually signed to their label. I don't know what the name of the label was, but pretty crazy.
Yeah, I had no idea Rob Cavallo had a hand in this one. That's interesting.
I'm willing to bet for the soundtrack he remixed it, because I've heard the trailer version. It definitely sounds a little rough. It sounds like the vocals are lower. If you like AB, the trailer version next to the Angus version, the vocals are definitely more front.
Okay. I always felt like Ash, they must have been the band that was getting the push at this time, because you think about how crazy it is to, okay, so you've got two songs on the soundtrack. That in itself is pretty nuts. And then you've got track two and track four. So you've got two songs in the first four songs of a soundtrack, and they let them leave clips at the beginning of both songs.
Which are not even in the movie, which was a huge source of confusion for me when I first heard this thing. What's this part? Is this in the movie? Because a lot of times soundtracks back then, remember they used to have the Young Guns 2 soundtrack had Emilio Estevez being like, "You, I'll make you famous," and then the song starts.
And this one, I timed it that the clip at the beginning of Jack Names the Planets, when the guy's talking about Planet New Venice, whatever, that's 18 seconds long. Wow. They let them leave an 18 second clip coming right off a Green Day, the single from the album. And you just basically gave them 20 seconds of rambling. And I just, I don't understand that. Like, you just chopped that off.
Yeah.
But like I said, Ash must have been somebody somewhere was like, these guys are going to be the next big thing, because two songs, and then you put them tracks two and four, leave the clips on. They must have really rubbed somebody the right way.
Yeah, that spoken section that we were talking about at the beginning, it's two Dutchmen. Oscar Wilde Vermeer and Patrick the Brewer Schrama, who apparently met Tim Wheeler during a holiday in France. So they're talking, they're suggesting that the song should have been called Jack Names the Planet New Venep. Given that, in their opinion, New Venep is a good name for a planet. New Venep is a town of like 30,000 inhabitants in like the Netherlands.
Oh my God.
Kind of like between The Hague and Amsterdam. Just like this like place. And it's just so, it's so random. And you're like, what is this on here? It has nothing to do with the movie. But you're right. They let it go. No qualms. Just boom, it's on there. Let people scratch their heads on this one.
It's amazing the shit that you can find out. I wouldn't even know where to begin to, like, you've got names, locations. Like, God, I've listened to this soundtrack a million times, and every time I've ever heard the clip at the beginning, I'm like, oh, it's just somebody trying to be funny and saying nonsense words.
This guy's in the band,
And it's like, no, it's actually, that's a real place that really exists.
It's nuts. Absolutely nuts. And the song is, it's cool. And it gets cooler from there. I mean, they've got this bizarre thing at the beginning. And then they have a song that was inspired by the 1984 Stephen King and Peter Straub book, The Talisman.
Okay.
Are you familiar with that book?
Vaguely. My girlfriend's a huge Stephen King fan, but I never read much of his stuff.
Yeah. So. Well, I haven't read this one either. It's about a fellow named Jack who can pop between worlds. He's trying to save his mom. And in this song, it starts off, "We were walking into worlds in the gardens of Sunlight Home." And in the book, Sunlight is the name of the school Jack and another character, Wolf, are held at as wards of the state for a month in the story. So I didn't know that until I dove into this thing. And I was like, wow, that makes the song a lot more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was a goofy, like, pop punk song about, I love you, baby. And then, but
cool. That's what I always thought too. It was just like, it was just a love song. Like, Jack names the planets after you. He just loves you.
How sweet.
But turns out, no.
Another cool bit of trivia for this song is they had a video for it, and interspersed throughout the music video are clips of the movie. And so George C. Scott, the great George C. Scott,
yeah,
is in this video for this band Ash. And so they're like one of the few bands that could claim, we've got George C. Scott in our video.
Yeah, man.
In our pop punk music video. All right, the next song on the soundtrack is Enough by the Dancehall Crashers. This song comes from the DHC's 1995 album Lockjaw on 510 Records. It was released at the end of August. And so, like we mentioned earlier, what you'll notice about the soundtrack is that a lot of the songs on it came from bands connected to Elliot Kahn and Jeff Salzman, that management team. And, of course, Rob Cavallo, who obviously had a lot of input into this soundtrack. He's listed as executive album producer. Again, I can't think of a better promotional tool than to get your songs in a movie. I mean, even a movie like this that wasn't like a blockbuster.
Yeah.
Still, it's such a smart move to get
your
music in movies. I mean, the memory that like is created when you watch the movie and you hear the song, it's brilliant.
Yeah. Well, and it's also, it's kind of a different sort of kind of strategy for like doing like a compilation where it's like, if you know, you're buying like a, you know, whatever, insert punk label here, you know, Fat Records is putting out a comp, and you're buying it to hear the new songs by the bands that you like, but that's all, you know, there's parameters there. Mm-hmm. They're fat bands. You already know them, you like them, maybe there's a new band or two on there. But a soundtrack, you know, it's like you've got people that like whatever pop band buying it, and then if you're a punk band and you're on there, you know, like how many people I knew that said, I got into the Smoking Pope because of the Clueless soundtrack,
right?
You know, yeah, where it's like, So, and it's like, but a lot of people, you know, were buying that soundtrack for like the Supermodel song or whatever.
Which, Jill Sawbuehl. I couldn't remember the name.
I was like,
you had the song, I had the artist. Nice.
Okay, perfect. But, you know, and so like for soundtracks, you know, this one isn't as varied in terms of the bands. But yeah, but I mean, yeah, what, like you, to your point, what a great tool, because you aren't just confined to a genre usually, you know?
Right. Enough is a great ska punk tune featuring the duo vocals of Elise and Karina. I just loved the song and often point to this as being one of the first few ska songs that I'd ever heard. And I didn't know it was ska back then. I was like, well, it's kind of a cool, like, you know, I didn't know what ska was. I actually, you know, because it sounded kind of bright and summery, I used to like call it surf music.
Oh, yeah.
Well, like summer surf music.
Yeah.
People must have looked at me like, dude.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's just a great breakup song where, you know, they plead for things that just go, you know, for things to go back the way they were. And I was, just liked this song. It was upbeat. It was fun. I liked the line, you know, I'm beginning to think that you drove me to drink. Not that I'm placing blame, but you're giving me a bad name.
This is just like you said, it's just a great song. It's fun. And I feel like Lockjaw was one of those records that at a point in time everybody had, you know. I mean, when I say everybody, it's like all the people I knew that were like into punk and ska and whatever, but it was just like, like Dancehall Crashers, like you just, of course I've heard Lockjaw, you know.
Right.
And it's just, it's a great record, and I don't care what anybody says, anybody our age had a ska phase.
Oh, sure.
If you say you didn't, you're lying, because everybody did.
I'm still in mine.
Yeah, no, I don't have any problem. I have a friend, actually, the guy that helped me do the horse cover, that awful, purposely awful, you know, like construction paper and whatever. And he, I mean, to this day, he's just like, no, ska is the best, best music. And I'm like, I can't argue with you. Ska. Like, yeah, man. And it's like, if you're into it.
All right, so let's move into the second Ash tune. This is Kung Fu by Ash. Oh. another song on the soundtrack, fourth song. It's a good one. It's a bit more up-tempo compared to Jack Names the Planets, a bit more Ramones-esque. Yeah. He mentions teenage lobotomy in the lyrics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just a silly song about love of kung fu movies. There's references to Fu Manchu and Mr. Miyagi.
Jackie Chan.
At one point he sings, "I can't live without my kung fu movies, Shanghai Killers, and Deadly Road." So, of course, I had to, like, Internet Movie Database those movies and be like, oh. This has nothing to do with Angus or the band, but I'm learning a lot about these old kung fu flicks.
It's the beauty of the Internet. Thank God. The way I'll end up at, you know, a point B from point A is it's all right there.
Wormhole. Yeah.
Well, yeah. You wake up in the middle of the night, can't fall back asleep, and then you wake up the next morning and open up like the tab on your phone, and you're like, "What the hell was I? Why did I look that up?" You know, I always liked this song, but I'm not gonna lie, I always hated the production. It's like they way over distort the bass, and then they bring it up so much in the mix.
It's really buzzy. Yeah.
It just kind of leaves this, like, I don't know the best way to describe it, like a film over it when you listen to it, you know, it almost sounds like it's going to like clip out. Like if your speakers are too loud, you know, like,
right.
And like I said, it's a great song. It's catchy, simple, fun, but like, just that kind of that's just riding through the whole song.
It's got like that as it's starting off, like that, like that weird noise.
Yeah.
That
came uh-huh.
So I was quickly on my phone looking while you were talking, because this, you know, it comes from, I don't know if it's a single or what it's from. And obviously Rob Cavallo had maybe an opera. I'm wondering if he had an opportunity to remix it. I'm thinking he did, but the version on the single or wherever this thing came from is even more like that.
This is the toned down version.
Yeah. So,
oh my.
Again, the vocals are lower. And so if you listen to them side by side, you'll notice the difference.
If I'd have heard this song with more distortion, I would have thought my headphones were broken.
Right.
Back in the day. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to Back to You by the Riverdales. This is definitely one of my favorite songs on the soundtrack. I love 100%. This song.
It's so good. It's so good. Dan Vapid is one of the greatest pop punk songwriters of all time.
Absolutely. I will not argue that. I just think he's great. I love his voice. I just love the plodding forward rhythm of this song. I just always loved
it. Yeah. I was a big Screeching Weasel fan. As far as the Riverdales, it was just all Dan Vapid for me. Not that I'm saying Ben Weasel's stuff sucked, but he was definitely doing a different thing than Dan was. Dan was his focus, you could tell on that, was the kind of simple melodic, you know, and Ben's was kind of more kind of high-pitched, aggressive.
Same word over and over again.
Yeah. This song is just perfection, man.
Yeah. Recorded in the winter of 95 at Sonic Iguana Studios in Indiana. Producer, engineer, Master Ogini. Guitarist Ben Foster, or Ben Weasel, if you will, contacted Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day to mix the album. Billy couldn't come out to Indiana because his wife was about to have a baby. So bassist Dan Schaefer, Dan Vapid, brought the music to him in California. So how about that? They want Billy Joe to do this thing. He can't come. They go out to him. The Riverdales were Dan Schaefer, Ben Weasel, and Dan Sullivan, all members at one time of Screeching Weasel. This song came off the Riverdales' debut album. I had this album for a few months before I caught Green Day on tour in 95. I had the soundtrack and I was excited because I knew who the Riverdales were.
Same,
they were going to open
deal.
For Green Day.
Same deal.
Yeah.
Insomniac
I only knew the
tour.
One song, but
yep.
I was super excited to see the Riverdales because, you know, they were on the soundtrack and I'd heard of them. And I'm like, oh, I've heard of these guys. It was like the first band that was like, I've heard of them. Like,
That was the first show I ever went to. It was Riverdales and Green Day.
Oh, nice. Anyway, like I said, it's just a great driving song that moves forward under Dan's strong vocal. He sings, "I know that I've been a fool to go back to you, but it's hard," because he adds, "and I can't help it. I get sentimental. It's inevitable. It drives me mental." It's just great.
And this is also one of those songs too, that I feel like when you're, you know, kind of that age, we were 15, 16, where, you know, like everything in terms of like relationships or whatever, you know, it's like this huge deal to you because you're young and everything is so intense and the, you know, your body's changing, the world's changing. And like, I remember this song, like, just feeling like so kind of like emotionally relatable, you know, if that makes sense.
Oh, totally.
Where it was just, you know, it wasn't like, oh, I'm going through this exact situation, but it was like, I was at that age where it was like, all of a sudden I was like, you know, oh, I like this girl and I wonder if she likes me. And this song just like felt like it just made me feel all of those things, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's,
Yeah. At that age, you go with what you know. So back to you, you're going to gravitate back to the things that were in your comfort zone or, you know, you're familiar with, because I mean, as you're learning about the world, that there's so many new things and it's scary. So it's like, back to you. I'm going to get back to the sentimental thing that I once enjoyed. All right. The next song is "Mrs. You and Me" by the Smoking Popes. Great band. Like I mentioned earlier, I
had
discovered the Smoking Popes on Clueless. Again, at my dad's office, I grabbed like a 5-song sampler of the Clueless soundtrack, and I just loved "Need You Around" because it was the
only song
I'd ever heard at that time where the guitarist is working really hard, you know, strumming the guitar really fast, and the singer is just like, taking his time. And I just thought that was the coolest thing.
Yeah.
You know, I just love their style, and I love Josh's voice. So when I heard this song, I was like,
100%.
Oh, a great song.
This was the first song of theirs I ever heard. It was 100% his voice. I was like, how does he sound like that?
So like, unique,
Yeah, and to be over that style of music, you know, like I remember being young and thinking like, this guy should be doing some like Frank Sinatra shit, you know, like he should be singing over an orchestra or something. And instead it was just this stripped down guitar, bass and drums, punkish rock. I was immediately in love. And like I said, I mean, still to this day, I'm 42 years old, that they're one of my favorite bands, and it's all started here.
Love those songs. Love Born to Quit, the album, which these songs come off of. And I actually have the I Need You Around 7-inch. I just love their sound. I love, you know, I love Duvall when he did that. I just think that he's got such a great, you know, like Vapid, he's got just a great ear for melody. Like everything he does just sounds good, you know?
And I'm assuming, like, have you ever seen him live?
I have not, no.
No? Oh, okay. No. I was just going to say, like, I've been fortunate. I've gotten to see them a few times live. He is flawless. It is insane how, you know, it just because, of, you know, a lot of people, it's you're touring and your voice starts to go. And it's not like the notes were even that easy to hit in the studio in the first place sometimes. Mm-hmm. And he just goes out and just makes it look so easy. He's definitely doing what he's supposed to be doing for sure.
Like, he's found his calling and he's living it.
Yeah. I wonder what because as we mentioned earlier, like they play Rubella first in the movie.
Yeah.
I kind of wonder if it was like, oh, we just want something that has this feel. Because, I mean, Rubella would have fit on here like gangbusters, you know?
Sure, yeah.
So, yeah, I wonder what that call was. I mean, who knows?
I was trying to figure that out. And the only thing I could think of was, you know, Born to Quit was actually released in 94. It was on like...
Oh, Johann Space label, record. Right.
Capitol re-released the album in 95. So they snatched it up. And then Reprise was part of Warner Brothers. So I wonder, I mean, there's a lot of songs on here from other labels. Geffen's got some songs on here.
Right.
Loser song. But I wonder if there was like some sort of like, who knows, like paperwork or like, you know, competition between the camps and terms and like all this stuff that of course would be boring as shit. But leads to like a really great song that's in the movie that's not on the soundtrack. Okay, why isn't it on there? I love the line, and I'd rather be too young than too old to feel the way I do about you. It's so dead on.
That is my favorite line. Yeah, and that to tie back into the Riverdale's thing I was talking about. Yes. Just the emotion of being like that age, and like hearing that line, like still like I mean, goosebumps, man. Like
and just get like pissed off because I'm like, I wish I could write shit like that.
I know, right? Like that's the thing. It's like that's the best stuff is when you're like. It like almost makes you angry. It seems so simple, but it's not simple, you know?
Yeah.
Hey everyone, I just wanted to take a moment to encourage you to follow the Talking Records podcast on Instagram and Twitter. We post frequently and would love for you to join the chatter on favorite records and songs. We also have a website, talkingrecordspodcast.com. If you're enjoying the show, please consider supporting us by purchasing a t-shirt from our website. It's a win-win situation for everyone. You get a fancy new Talking Records t-shirt, and we get a little help updating our gear and maintaining our website. Plus, everyone around you gets to see you in a spiffy new shirt. You can also support us by spreading the word about our podcast. Do you know anyone who'd be interested in album details and stories? What about that person at work you've been meaning to strike up a conversation with? You can also review us where you listen to podcasts. All these things would be a tremendous help to us.
We kick off Side B with You Gave Your Love to Me Softly by Weezer. From Geffen Records comes Weezer and a song from around the Pinkerton era of songwriting, which is a pretty crazy era if you ever look into it. Rivers had abandoned his Songs from the Black Hole project. Matt had started the Rentals. Rivers had major surgery to correct, like one of his legs was longer than the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And during that, like that crazy time, somehow and all that, they got the song out. It was actually the second choice for the film. Another song, Wanda, which was never released and never officially recorded, was the song the band had initially written for Angus. It was rejected because the song didn't sound Weezer enough. Rivers got to see the script of the movie and actually included specific elements from the movie in the song, which I think would have been kind of cool. Like,
I read about that too. And I just thought, like, well, what a dog shit reason to reject something. If you're like, hey, here's a copy of the script. Can you write a song for the movie? And then they're like, oh, you wrote it too literally. What? Right. Like, get out of here.
We didn't want a theme song. You know?
Yeah.
We wanted a Weezer song.
And I love that he called it Wanda.
Yeah.
You know, that's the name of the blow-up doll that he
the blow-up doll.
With. And I just thought, like, how great is it? Because, like, have you heard the song? Like, he recorded it's on, like, his demos thing.
Yeah, I guess it's on Alone, the home recordings.
Yeah, and you know, it sounds like there was never like an official Weezer recording or whatever, mm-hmm. but
yeah.
But it's like this sweet, tender song, you know, and it is it's slower and whatever. But then the fact that he just called it Wanda, you're the love of my life or whatever. I just thought I thought that was just brilliant.
Yeah.
Like he just was like, I'm going to name it after the fucking blow-up doll. And then write this sweet, tender song. And and it really does like tie in the movie. Like there's a lot of specific references. Mm-hmm. And I get if they wanted something that sound different, but to be like, you wrote it too literally, I think is just, that's garbage.
Reject. Well, we got, You Gave Your Love to Me Softly, which is a great song. It's
song.
It's driving. It's, you know, like a lot of the songs on here, it really moves. Maybe that's what they wanted. It's got big energy. It's certainly one of the fastest Weezer songs
that
I had heard at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a song about reflecting back on a tender moment. I feel like it would have fit perfectly on Pinkerton. A moment that was like too brief. I think he mentions in the song, all I have to do is think of you. We had just one night, but it lingers on and on and on. And so, you know, pining over what could have been.
Yeah. And have you ever heard the version that they recorded for Pinkerton? It's like a different version.
Yeah, there's no Moog in it. Yeah.
And it's like, you can still obviously tell it's a great song, but this version for me will always be like the version. you know.
Well, I really like that. I really like that keyboard. I think. Yeah. Maybe I've heard it so many times that when it's not there, I'm like, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah. Me and Jay from Symphony of Distraction, we always used to kind of touch on that, where the first version of a song that you hear is always going to be your favorite version, unless it was just a really crappy, cassette recorder demo. But just because that's the one, you're like, no, that's how it sounds to me now.
Yeah.
And when you hear it done differently, you're like, no, that's not right. You know? But yeah. This great song and the version they put on here is fantastic.
The next song is Ain't That Unusual by the Goo Goo Dolls. From the album A Boy Named Goo, released in March of that year. I mean, I had actually purchased a Goo Goo Dolls cassette tape back in 94 at a used record shop. And I only bought it because the album was titled Jed.
Okay.
they have an album called Jed. Nice. And I bought it. And I remember popping it in. It's grungy, like loud punk rock. The bassist sings all the songs on it except for two songs.
Wow, yeah.
And it's rough. So I remember when these songs came out. I probably heard this before name. I don't remember. But I just remember being like, oh, this band has the same name as that shitty punk band.
Yeah, yeah. Like
has an album with my name on it. But it was just so crazy. And poorly produced and, just crazy. So anyway, Name, like I said, had been a huge hit that fall. And, I didn't really care much for that song. But I liked a lot of the songs on that record. They were kind of poppy and fun. Long Way Down is a great song. And I really like this song. And I love where it plays in the movie when they're getting off the bus.
They're getting off the bus in the beginning, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It fits perfectly. I mean, you couldn't use You Gave Your Love to Me Softly there or Jack Names the Planet. It's like this song is perfect for that.
Yeah. And it kind of, if I remember right, it's like slow mo when they're getting off the bus and it's like kind of windy. Yeah.
The 90s slow mo.
Yeah. It just worked. When I go back now and I listen to this song, please, if anyone ever hears this, don't hunt me down and kill me because I'm not making a direct comparison between the two bands. But this song to me now, sort of sounds like the Goo Goo Dolls tried to write a replacement song.
Definitely.
You know what I mean? That's not me saying, I mean, I love the Replacements. I'm not really a fan of the Goo Goo Dolls.
So
I'm not saying, yeah. But, you know, I mean, you can hear it in some of their other stuff, obviously. But this song in particular to me just really feels like this is the, they've got the blinders on. And it's like, what do we sound like writing a replacement song? And I feel like this song is the most Goo Goo Dolls replacement try I've ever heard. And that being said, I like the song. I think it's a great song. I like the guitar. I think the guitar solo is great. But yeah, it's they've had a funny ass career, right? I mean,
career arc is so bizarre.
It's insane. Like you said, to go from that kind of dirty, grungy, shitty production to being the Iris band.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that just gets known for these...
these giant acoustic
enormous ballads, yeah. It was bizarre.
Interestingly, this song almost didn't make it on Boy Named Goo. Early advanced copies did not include the song. And so I was wondering if they were saving it for the soundtrack and then at the last minute, we'll just put it on the album. But there's a lot of interesting background to this band and this time period. I guess the band's situation with their label, Metal Blade Records, was really bad.
Yeah, which is strange that they were on Metal Blade. I mean, that's a legit metal label.
And I don't know what sort of agreements or decisions were being made, but it just sounds like it was a really tough situation. And the song is actually about wanting something so badly, but not being able to get it. Everything I want, I haven't got. Sick of everything I'm not. Put my heavy coat on for a while. It's freezing in the corner of my mind. And I know with troubles with the label, their drummer, they were in the process of kicking out their drummer at that time.
Oh, really?
And they had all these albums under their belt, but none of them were success. It's like when you've got five albums out, you sort of feel like you should be progressing maybe.
I don't know.
I think at this time, I've heard rumors that they were going to quit. Like they were going to stop Like, if this record wasn't successful, they were done, you know?
That's what I was just going to say is there's something to be said for motoring on when you've had five records out that haven't really done shit. Yeah. And, I mean, anybody logically would be like, all right, we tried. Like, good job, guys. We gave it all we had, but it's not in the cards. Now I'm going to go work for my fucking dad or something.
Yeah.
And they motored on and it worked, you know, which not definitely how it usually happens.
I get the sense that someone was like, all right, here's what you got to do. Guitarist is the singer.
Yeah.
don't let that other guy sing anymore.
Yeah.
Do some big string ballads and you guys will be golden.
Yeah. And give him the fucking Rachel haircut from Friends.
Yeah. Oh man, that's good. Anyway, I always appreciated the line in this song. It's like a made for TV movie and I just blew my lines.
Yeah.
I think that's great. I don't know. It says so much with so little.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good one.
Yeah. I really like that line too.
The next song on the album is one of my favorites, Funny Face by the Muffs. Funny Face comes from the remarkable Muffs album, Blonder and Blonder. I just love the song itself, but the huge sound of the guitars and drums, you know, that Rob Cavallo, you know, sound. He must have just like applied the same settings to this Muffs album that he did for Insomniac. To me, Insomniac and Blonder sound very similar.
I can see that. Yeah. Yeah. Well, because I mean, that, you know, that just became his thing where it was like that huge, like, thick, meaty, you know, guitar tone.
Right.
And I mean, God, he nailed it, you know?
Yeah. But you got this deep sound. And then on top, you've got Kim Shattuck's amazing, like, growly vocal. I just love that. No. I hadn't heard anything like that. Like a female singer who wasn't trying to be like Celine Dion, you know, she was up there just like screaming in your face. And I was like, this is awesome.
And doing it in a way, like I always thought like her voice, it was just like, nobody else could sound like that.
No.
You couldn't even begin to try, you know, cause it was
so
just
intense.
It was brutal, man. And like, awesome, you know, I mean, it would just, you know, like they used to say, like, I forget who, some musician, but I remember this old interview where they were talking about Nirvana and saying how sometimes Kurt Cobain's voice hurt to listen to, you know, like when he would hit that high rasp and like clench up and, you know, but meaning it obviously as a compliment, like he's putting so much into it that you as a listener are like, oh my God, like I can physically feel that. And I feel like her voice is kind of the same way, where it's just like, how did you figure out you could even do that?
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy. And to do it over such melodic music.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. She's a great songwriter too. And just putting that all together. It was such a unique sound. It was so good.
Yeah.
I just loved the Muffs.
Yeah. And they were on a major, right, for a while?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, it's like, it's funny because you kind of think this band should have been huge, but it's also kind of like, how are they going to get huge? Like, you know.
The mainstream never would have accepted.
No.
That, which is so, it's like such a bummer. But
Yeah. It's like, they'll put up with fucking Boys to Men Six Ways from Sunday. But, you know, a band like the Muffs, it was just like, there was no way. You know,
just raw energy. Yeah.
Yeah. So good.
I'm not sure what the song is actually about. Maybe a post breakup song. Funny Face could have been the nickname she gave someone who's now someone she's trying to get away from. I don't know. It's like, you know, it's kind of shrouded, but just a great song. I love the way it sways. It's just, you know, big sound.
Yeah.
It's a great song. And it's followed up by White Homes by Tilt.
Sleeping.
This is a song from 1993's Play Cell, the album Tilt did with Lookout Records before signing on with Fat. Like Kim Shattuck of the Muffs, Tilt vocalist Cinderblock is just a powerful performer with such a distinct vocal.
Yeah.
Again, so amazing to have all these great indie bands packed onto the soundtrack. On one side, you have people like Cavallo and the Con Man management team who wanted to get their music into people's ears. And then on the other side, a film studio that was either totally on board with this, like, yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, do it.
Or, you know, just like didn't care because they saw it as a cheap way like to get some music in their film. I don't know, but
yeah,
we benefit.
I mean, yeah, like when you look, you know, like what you've got, like Tilt, Pansy Division and the Riverdale. I mean, you've got three Lookout bands on a actual studio. Like this wasn't some indie film, you know, this was
put a major motion picture.
Yeah. And with a soundtrack on a major label and you've got three Lookout bands out of 12 songs. That's insane, story. Man. Like, wow.
I would say that this song probably has the best lyrics on the album. Cinderblock starts right in with, "White frame homes to live in leave nothing to gain. Your colorless divinities can scarcely light the way. White frame lies in celibate rows. They swell and meld together. Aspirations live in possessions. Each dweller's dream so similar."
Yeah. Shit.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Pretty good. Just a jab at the mundane scene of suburban home life and, you know, the white picket fence and all that cookie cutter stuff. And it's just like, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Stick that in your teen movie and shove it.
Right? Yeah. Think about your PG-13 piece of shit.
Yeah. It's great.
I always thought it was really interesting, like, that they put the Muffs and Tilt back to back on this soundtrack.
Yeah.
I felt... And to expand on that, just because I've been so obsessed with the soundtrack for so many years and I've done so many deep dives, is I sort of feel like after the Weezer song, they kind of quit giving a shit about sequencing. Because the way that it flows up until the Weezer song, it feels like intentionally sequenced like you would a record. Mm. And, you know, I'm a huge sequencing guy. People care about it less now because it's like, you know, you put singles on Spotify and that's how people listen to music. But I still, it's like, no, sequencing. And after the Weezer song, it sort of feels like they were like, okay, we got this many songs left. Obviously the last song, which we'll get into in a few, was going to be the last song. But the kind of like 8, 9, 10, 11, it just feels like they were like, well, we're putting them on here. And they just kind of
couldn't figure out where to put them.
Yeah. So it was like, so yeah, I mean, like putting like the Muffs and Tilt, especially because like Cinderblock and like Kim Shattuck have such similar delivery styles, like that kind of hard,
growly,
gruff. Yeah. Like, and so to just put them back to back, I always thought was kind of an interesting choice. Cause I feel like you kind of want to separate those to make each song kind of stand out a little more. But Definitely. Then also I realize I'm overthinking it because it was probably just some old dumb white guy that was like, I don't know, there, put it there, you know, like, and meanwhile, I'm poring over it being like, no, you
trying
don't
to
understand
the essence. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I hear that though. Like, that's a really interesting point. And it's not to say that those songs aren't good and like, oh, those are the throwaway tracks, but you're right. Like it's sort of, it seems very deliberate on side A.
Yeah.
And then side B is, I totally hear that. I can't really explain why, but that's a really good point.
And, you know, and it doesn't make it, you know, obviously the songs any worse, but it's like you had 12 songs to sequence and you kind of sequenced half of them. Yeah. It feels like anyway, you know, and you gave fucking Ash two songs in the first, like, space them out. If you
left off
Rubella. What are you doing?
And yet it's still an amazing soundtrack.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. The only reason we're even complaining is because we're still listening to it, you know, almost 30 years later.
Exactly.
And it's like, you guys did your job right. So, I'll, you know, what the hell do I know?
You gotta find something to complain about, right? We're human beings. Yeah. We're complainers.
Yeah. How much fun would it be if this whole podcast was just, it's great. It is great.
The next song is Deep Water by Pansy Division.
deep water, pulling me down. Deep water, afraid I'll drown. I hear the gays go to San Francisco.
From 1994's Deflowered, I had seen Pansy Division open for Green Day on the 94 Dookie Tour. They rolled through town. They were in Amherst, and I live in Massachusetts, and what an experience.
Yeah.
My dumb 14-year-old brain had never considered anything much beyond, like, my front door, you know, or what was on Seinfeld, or, you know, whatever. And at this show, I learned a ton about what it really meant to be gay, you know, the problems of, you know, the stereotypes from movies and TV shows, stuff like that. And so here were these like regular dudes up on stage playing kick-ass songs, and they were like totally in your face about it. They weren't ashamed, you know? And I just remember being like really impressed by that. Mm-hmm. They were up there yelling about, they had a song called like the Cocksuckers Club. That was one of the ones I remembered. Yes. And I was like, wow, you know?
Yeah.
It was very in your face, but it was to the point. I think that was the point.
Yeah.
Their whole thing was like, this is who we are.
Well,
you know?
Fuck you. I don't need to act any different, you know?
Yeah.
And I always thought like it was so cool that Green Day was this.
Yeah.
Like that's when Green Day was becoming Green Day and the shows were getting bigger. And I'm sure there were people in their camp that were like, please do not take Pansy Division with you. Please.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I remember hearing shit where it was like certain venues were like, we're not going to let them play. And Green Day's like, well, fucking we're not playing.
Well, then we're not playing. Yeah. Yeah. That was amazing.
And like, you know, to just kind of have that end to end Pansy Division, I can't even imagine some of the shit they had to put up with going out in front of these big crowds in, you know, the middle of fucking some town in Iowa or wherever, you know?
Right. The whole lacrosse team is there to see Green Day.
And... Yeah. And then you're up there, you know, just openly being like, we're gay and fuck you if you don't like it. And I bet there was a lot of people that were like, fuck you, I don't like it. And, but they went out every night and did it. And, you know, and I'm sure too that with that many people at a show, there had to have been people there that, you know, saw Pansy Division and were, you know, maybe kind of going through their own shit.
Yeah.
And were like, you know, it was helpful and
emboldened
kind of,
to be like,
you know,
I identify with that. That's me, you know?
Yeah. It's just like that whole thing of like them and Green Day at that time is just, it's so cool. And it's just so awesome that
it's a great story
that they gelled that way. And like, yeah. And then I remember when I got this soundtrack and it was like, I don't know if I'd really heard Pansy Division, but I just knew them from all the getting into shit on tour where it was like Green Day's touring with this band and then you won't let them play and whatever. And so I was like, oh, that's the band that opened for Green Day. And so, yeah, I think this was probably my first Pansy Division song.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Deep Water is about being a young man who identifies as gay and feeling alone, singled out. He longs for San Francisco where, quote, I hear the gays go, but it's too far away and he's stuck in his own town and probably a place that, you know, he feels stifled and rejected. It feels like deep water and he's afraid he'll drown. And that, you know, obviously a very on point song about how many people were probably feeling growing up and feeling isolated and feeling alone.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just the fact that they were able to get that out there in front of these giant crowds and like probably, like you said, have people walk away from there being like, yeah, I, you know, that's me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I feel a little bit more, you know, empowered to be me. And I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
The soundtrack concludes with Am I Wrong by Love Split Love.
I'm so tired of my mood, and sleep comes with a knife fork in this room. You're so pale in your face, you let life get in your way.
from the band's album Love Split Love on Imago Records. This was actually a side project of the Psychedelic Furs singer Richard Butler. And this song seems like an out of place song on the album. You know, you got all these pop punk tunes and mm-hmm. also you've got the Psychedelic Furs dude singing this, like, you know,
yeah,
it's kind of acoustic-y thing, but great song. And what a great closer to the record.
And yeah, like I was going to kind of bring up the same thing. Like, this is obviously the most out of place,
mm-hmm.
but a great song is a great song, and it works. It totally works. Like, it doesn't sound as out of place as it should coming at the end of listening to a, I mean, you fucking backed it up to Pansy Division. You know what I mean? Like, but it's such an amazing song.
It's that great.
It works. It'll work anywhere. A good song will find a way. It's a good song, you know? And that this soundtrack is the only place that they released that marching band version from the
from the
movie, because the version on their record is just all that stuff's
just straight up.
And I loved that. Like, I remember seeing the movie like the first time, like the credits scene.
Yeah.
The opening credits, and they've got like the snare line and like horns come in.
They're rolling. Like,
yeah.
I love that meld. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't need anyone to start like marching band corps anytime soon.
Yeah. But
it just works for this song. And I love the placement in the movie. I just, mm-hmm. I think that it sets up the movie. The marching band's on the field. It's like, you know, maybe the coolest marching band in the whole world because they're playing rock tune, you know?
Yeah.
And they've got that marching band part in there. And then if you go listen to the actual album version, it's not there. And I expect it to be there. So I'm like, this song's missing something pretty important.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. And another thing that's kind of interesting about this song is it's obviously, like we said, it's a great song, but it doesn't really have a chorus. You know, it has your,
maybe the,
you
know, goodbye, lay the blame
on luck. But I mean, you know, that, and you know, that's, I guess, what you would consider the chorus. But but in terms of that kind of strict, like, it's kind of a testament to how good the song is, that I didn't realize that till probably the last few years, to be completely honest. The verse, that melody, the da-na-na-na-na. I have had to edit that melody out of God knows how many songs that I've written since I was a teenager. Because I didn't even realize. And I would be like, fuck, that's a great melody. And I'd be like, oh my God, I did it again. I took
that's
Am I Wrong? Because it just works anywhere over anything. And, you know, it's luckily good. I've caught it every time. But it's like, I mean, it's so good. This song is so great. And, you know, the kind of irony that it doesn't feel out of place on a record like this, you know, is just.
Yeah, that's a funny story. I actually have a funny misheard lyrics story about this song. So I thought the line, "And sleep comes with a knife, fork, and a spoon," toward the end of the song, was actually, "When sleep comes, will the knife forget the spoon?" now that I've said that, you're going to hear that. Will the knife forget the spoon?
Will the knife forget
Thought was a brilliant lyric because I was like, yeah, you know, knives and forks are always paired together. And, you know, would the knife forget the spoon? And it was like so, like, thinking about it. I remember I got into an argument with somebody about it. I'm like, that's a great lyric. But anyway, you know, a metaphor for the third wheel. But I totally blew it because that's not the lyric at all.
Dude, I mean, I can't think of any specific instances, but like I've done that too, like so much where you're like, and whatever you miss here is like more profound to you than whatever actually ends up being. Yeah, no, I totally get it. Yeah, that's funny though. Like, I think it's also, it's kind of funny that they, I'm blanking on his name, the singer from the Psychedelic Furs.
Richard Butler.
The one, the interview I was talking about earlier that I listened to with Charlie Talbot, and the guy the guy interviewing him kind of made some joke, which was funny because I've like thought this before, where it's like he's got this song and this great teen comedy, and it's like he's also the guy responsible for Pretty in Pink, you know what I mean? Like that song, it's like you know, like 12, 13, however many years apart, and it's like he's mm-hmm. still just killing the teen soundtrack game, you know.
He's found his calling.
Yeah.
In closing, Angus might not have been a huge blockbuster. It was a silly teenage film based on a book. And if anyone remembers it, they remember it more for being that movie with the girl from Jurassic Park in it. But a whole bunch of us know this movie for a different reason. We cherish the soundtrack, this compilation of up-and-coming punk and ska acts, who had the rare opportunity to get their music into a film. And not a giant, grandiose Tom Cruise film, cheapening the songs, but a small film about a kid who gets picked on by Dawson's Creek and ends up coming out on top in the end. I kind of like this movie. It may be because of the music or the fact that my best friend and I at the time liked to dig up old movies and go around quoting them, but the whole package just fits together nicely. All these years later, still talking about Angus.
Like I said before, I just think it was perfect for the time, and we were the right age, and the songs and the movie itself were just so relatable. And I actually made a note here that I always felt like the scene where Rick, James Vanderbeek, punches Angus in the face at the dance in front of everyone, and Angus, you know, is knocked backward, and Rick just looks at him and says, "Welcome to high school, Angus." I always felt that was the best metaphor for my high school experience ever. You know, not literally getting punched, but just that, just sort of, this is what it's like. You're just going to get blasted in the face and have to just get up and keep going.
Steve, I would like to thank you so much for hanging out with me today and talking about Symphony of Distraction and going through the Angus soundtrack with me today. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm so glad this all started because you recognized the Angus quote on the new Symphony of Distraction record, which I've been trying to put, I told you, on every record since the band started, and I finally got it on there, and that's how all this came about. So
that's great.
Thank you so much.
I heard that and I was like,
I tried to push it, man, and then I tried to sneak it in this time, and Jay was like, yeah, we can use it, and I was like, really, finally?
Yeah,
like, it's my Angus quote. Like,
yeah. That's so funny.
Yeah, but thanks a bunch, man. This was a lot of fun, and I'm glad we got to shine a light on the Angus soundtrack for people that maybe haven't heard it or kind of forgot about it. So
absolutely. I'd like to send a huge thank you to my man Craig for all the behind the scenes stuff that he does. I'd like to thank Chris Tamakes from Less Than Jake for the theme music. I'd like to send a huge thank you to all of you for tuning into Talking Records. It is so much fun to dive into these songs and dig up all this information and talk about all this stuff. You know, try to gather up everything we can and just pack it all into this one little podcast here. Definitely check us out on the socials, say hello, suggest albums, tell us your stories, let us know when you first heard the Angus soundtrack, which songs you loved, which songs you didn't care for, your favorite scene from the movie, whatever. Reach out to us. Steve, where can people find Symphony of Distraction, La Manta, all your projects?
Everybody is on all of the socials. I think La Manta is La Manta Rips, and then Symphony of Distraction is just Symphony of Distraction. So, yeah.
Definitely check them out. Love you guys. Love both bands. Second Shot, love them too.
Yeah. Old school. The gift that keeps on giving. That band has spurred how many bands by now? Yeah, thanks, man.
All right, Steve. Well, thanks so much for hanging out.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jed. I really, really had a good time.